Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program showcasing radio productions from this and many other independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. War and mental hell is our topic as we mark Veterans Day week 2009.
He fought one time, and he fought a separate kind of war the second time, and he was a casualty of that war the second time.
The military is so overstretched that troops being redeployed often have traumatic brain injury, TBI.
This man's behavior on the basis of the news that we have should really show a red flag.
U.S. Marine Corps veteran Charles McKinney tells his son's story. First Sergeant Jeffrey McKinney died in Iraq in 2007. Journalist Dar Jamail talks about the Fort Hood shootings, and psychiatrist Jamshid A. Marvasti of Connecticut looks at the likely motives of alleged Fort Hood shooter, military psychiatrist Nadal Malik Hassan. First, it is part of military culture. Soldiers are not supposed to have nervous breakdowns. It runs counter to the image of the brave GI, loyal to his fellow soldiers. But the story of Jeff McKinney suggests that bravery and loyalty were not in question. His brain function may have been, after numerous exposures to blasts. Jeff's father is working to help the military understand what happened to his son and prevent other soldiers from having to go through it. Mr. McKinney, where did you serve? I understand you were in the Marines.
I was in Da Nang, Vietnam for a year, in 1964-65 time period. In a helicopter squadron. I served 4 years in the Marine Corps.
Tell us a little bit about your son, Jeff, and his Iraq War story.
Jeff joined the Army his junior year in high school, as a matter of fact, so that he could go to boot camp and be in the Army Reserves. And then after he graduated high school, he could go active duty. And he did that at 18 years old. Jeff served 19 and a half years. Two tours in Iraq. He was in Egypt as part of the peacekeeping force there. Jeff was an Army Ranger, airborne. He was going to get out at 20 years, but whenever his name came up to make E8, Master Sergeant, he had to give him 2 more years, so he decided he was going to stay in. And that's when he was made First Sergeant of the company in Iraq, a combat unit in Iraq again. And he was really looking forward to that. He was so proud. His email was, you know, sent home, says, "Dad, I'm the highest ranking officer, non-commissioned officer in the company." And he was so proud of that, you know. He just gave his life to the Army. That was his life. He has a wife in Germany, and I had 2 grandsons in Germany. That's where Jeff's buried. He had asked her if anything happened to him. He wanted to be buried there in Darmstadt, in a little area where they live. So we all agreed to that, and I went there in August to see him. So that was my son. He was a very gentle person. He was very hard to anger. He's patient. You know, like everybody else, he had his faults and he had his shortcomings, but, you know, he had his dreams and he didn't get to fulfill his dreams because of the effects, we feel like, primarily of traumatic brain injury. He had suffered several IEDs his first tour. He was in Bradley fighting vehicles, and his Bradley got hit several times, and he was fortunate, and no one was wounded bad, no one died, and he used to laugh and call himself the EOD, which is Explosive Ordnance Disposal, because he could find them and blow them up and not kill anybody in his unit, in his vehicle. But we think the percussions of those blasts, the blast caused traumatic brain injury to him, and I think he sat there for a year while he was home, and then he had to go back again. There was like several days before he died. He was in a Humvee, and they hit a huge IED. It blew up 2 feet in front of him and just rocked their vehicle. And the men with him in the vehicle said that had it hit the vehicle, it would have all been dead. And the medics seem to think that triggered the really effective Jeff there, that brain injury there, plus the horrendous losses that the unit was taking. His battalion lost 31 men on that tour there, most since Vietnam for one battalion. And Jeff was pulling dead bodies and seeing things, you know, that just, I think he felt like he was the father and he had to take care of these young men, and he couldn't. And he couldn't do anything about it. And it was just, he didn't know how to recognize the symptoms of what he was going through, and he didn't know what to do about it, I don't think. And he wouldn't ask for help because he was just too proud. I think the stigma of the military is part of that, is what causes these guys not to ask for help. They won't do it.
You mean the stigma of reaching out for mental health services?
That's right. you're supposed to be the tough leader, and you don't, that's with any, not just the leader, any of them. If a person goes, he shows a weakness in the military's eyes, we believe, and so they won't go do it. They won't go ask for help. And also, too, they've gone and asked for help. And I've heard the stories at our suicide seminar of families that went and said, we need help. He's saying he's going to commit suicide, and they just turn him away. It didn't help him. So I think the stigma goes all the way up. It's the old school, the macho thing that these guys just suck it up and deal with it and get out there and do your job.
Did your son want to go back, or was he stop-lost?
No, he had been stop-lost, too. He still had another year and a half before he could get out, but he didn't really want to go back, and he said when he was home in 2006, he came home on leave, said, Dad, I don't really want to go. He had just gotten married, and he was going to start his family again, you know, a new family, and he said, but, you know, that's my place, and that's my job, and I'm not going to leave the men, because he was going to be in the same unit again. He said, I'm not going to leave those men without his leadership anyway, because he knew so many of them. So he would have gotten out this year, and his time would have been up.
You told the newspaper that there had also been a really bad incident where some kids had been killed, and evidently your son, Jeff McKinney, a first sergeant, told you, I'll never be the same again.
That's what he said. I think that impacted him because of the age, the children, and he says, and those are the innocent ones that suffer. And he said he could hear the mother screaming and the siblings screaming about the loss of their children. And they were blaming the Americans. And he said it wasn't our fault. He said we were having a crossfire. And he said it was a firefight going on. But he said he would never be the same after that. And, you know, Jeff had grown up a real sportsman. He liked guns and he liked shotguns. And he was an excellent shot at trap shooting. And he liked being around guns. And I think that's part of why he liked the military so much. But after he came home from that tour, I'd bought him a deer rifle the year before, and I had it here with me at home. And I said, Jeff, what do you want me to do with the deer rifle? You want to take it with you? And he said, no. He said, Dad, I don't think I want to do it anymore. He said, I don't like guns anymore. He said, I don't want anything. He said, I'll carry one in my job because that's what my job is. That's what I have to do. But I don't want guns anymore. He said, I don't want to deal with them. So.
Was he able to have any medical testing after his exposure to blasts?
The signs were there. He was exhibiting signs of zoning out. He would zone out for 2 hours at a time, his company commander said, and constantly going around telling the guys, he said, I'm not doing a good job. I'm not doing my job as the first sergeant. I'm doing a lousy job. I'm not a good leader. And they put him on some medications for sleep, I guess, is what it was supposedly for. The medic had given him Ambien. As a matter of fact, the night before he died, that's what they gave him. The company commander said, if you don't sleep 10 hours tonight, first sergeant, you're not going out on patrol tomorrow. The medic gave him Ambien, and he supposedly took it and slept maybe 8 or 9 hours. And when he got up the next morning, though, the gunner on his vehicle said he was in a trance. He was like he was asleep and didn't know what was going on around him. He was playing with things. He wouldn't answer radio calls. They tried to get him to coordinate the air cover, and he just sat and stared at the microphone in his hand, said his hands were shaking. And he couldn't do it, and he was playing with a bullet in his hand, and he threw it on the floor a couple of times. And I guess he had said something to the guys. He really missed his family and missed home, you know. But they said he was zoned out at that time. His wife, he talked to her the weekend before, Sunday night. He said, I can't even make simple decisions or think simple thoughts right now. And he says, I'm so sleepy. And he went to sleep talking to her on the telephone. And she says, Jeff, please go to the doctor tomorrow and get help. And he said, okay, I will. And he didn't do it. He didn't go. He fought one war one time, and he fought a separate kind of war the second time, and he was a casualty of that war the second time.
Mr. McKinney, also, I understand you tried to tell the Department of Defense your thoughts at a TAPS meeting recently on what might be done to help resolve this crisis of, you know, soldiers killing themselves.
The three things I told them that in my mind One was the effects of prescribed medication. They have got to develop a system to monitor the effects of those medications because you've got a little corpsman out there, not even the doctor or the PA, physician, but a corpsman giving medication, prescribing drugs, and some things like Ambien and some of those drugs could be used for depression, but they also can cause suicidal thoughts. What works for one may not work for another one. So if you don't monitor what the effects those medications are having on those troops and keep track of it, I guess, and know what it is, I think it's a disaster waiting to happen. The other thing I told him was I still think that traumatic brain injury. People are experiencing the symptoms of that while they're in a combat zone, not when they come home And a lot of them are taking their own lives after they come home, but just happened while he was there. And I think that we need to be proactive in diagnosing that instead of waiting until they come home and then say, okay, we'll look at it now. And to me, if they experience more than one IED or roadside bomb, they need the medical examination, a complete one, and say, is this soldier okay, or you know, sailor, whoever it is, Marine or whatever it is, and medical evaluation. And I think that we need leadership accountability. That's whenever you've got leaders, and we had a prime example of Jeff. His company commander saw the symptoms that Jeff was going through and even said he saw him. He saw him zoning out. Jeff would go talk to him for an hour or two at a time and tell him how he felt like he wasn't doing a good job. So those leaders have to be able to stand up when they see that and make the decision that regardless of the outcome of how to fix that person, whether that person wants to be pull them off the line or put them out of combat. Because I've said it so many times, my wife and I both have said it, that day Jeff could very easily have turned that weapon on those other men too, his own men, because of the condition he was in. And he would never do it knowingly, but the trance and the condition he was in that day, the state of his mind, and I don't know if that's what caused this thing at Fort Hood or not, but I think that could very easily have been Jeff doing something like that. And then what for that company commanders, you know, or any of the leadership, I think their thoughts are, well, I can't pull him off the line because he would lose the respect to his men. That's what he told us, and he told CID investigators, that he would lose the respect to his men, and it would ruin his career. And again, there, my thoughts were, you know, I would rather have a live Jeff at home, maybe that his men didn't respect him, and I know that wouldn't be the case, than I would have a dead one, because that captain didn't have the judgment or use the judgment to say, look, this person needs help, he needs mental evaluation or mental help, and we need to pull him off because it could impact the other soldiers. But I think the leaders say, we just need boots on the ground, and because they're fighting a war. That was one of my big concerns there, was the leadership accountability all the way up, because I just don't think they take it seriously enough.
Charles McKinney of Bedford, Texas, a former Marine, a Vietnam veteran. We're so sorry for your loss, Mr. McKinney, and we do honor your son's memory during this Veterans Day week, 2009.
We appreciate that, and it's good to hear that.
November, the day is all yours, so I sing this song for all you have done, a bold and brave American son.
The deeper one digs, the more apparent it becomes that the military is in a state of near collapse.
Even before the Fort Hood shootings, the U.S. military was in crisis mode, reports journalist Dar Jamail. He covered Iraq as an unembedded journalist during early years of the war.
With the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, more than 565,000 troops have been deployed more than once. By December 2006, it was estimated that 50% of troops in Iraq were serving their second tour, and another 25% were on their third or fourth tour. We can dramatically increase those numbers now. The military is so overstretched that troops being redeployed often have traumatic brain injury, TBI, from surviving roadside bombs in previous deployments, and more than 43,000 troops listed as medically unfit have been deployed anyway. Soldiers already diagnosed with PTSD and other severely debilitating mental health conditions that accompany it are being redeployed as the military dredges up troops to keep enough boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. By October 2007, the Army reported that approximately 12% of combat troops in Iraq were coping by taking antidepressants or sleeping pills.
After reporting on massive civilian casualties in Iraq, Dar Jamail returned home to cover a growing U.S. military resistance movement. He's now on a book tour discussing his recent book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan.
One ramification of a growing number of soldiers who are publicly refusing orders is that it does inspire others to follow suit.
During the early stages of war and occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Bush White House portrayed those who disagreed with U.S. policy as unpatriotic. But peace activists are now playing a significant role in calling attention to the crisis U.S. soldiers are facing as they're forced to redeploy under stop loss indefinitely.
If more and more people than will see before they actually join the military. Oh, well, here's this military that is involved in both these occupations, but there's also a growing number of people within that military stepping out and going to jail because they're so passionate in their beliefs not to deploy, then maybe I shouldn't join that military. And we are starting to see that, actually. I was at Fort Hood in Central Texas. It's the biggest base in the country. It's the most heavily deployed base in the country. And that's where the two court-martials took place most recently, of Sergeant Travis Bishop and Specialist Victor Augusto, who both had served in Iraq and then refused to go to Afghanistan. And the GI Resistance Coffee House is called Under the Hood Cafe. I was there the night before the court-martial, and I was there with an active duty troop at Fort Hood, and he said, you know, since these guys have stood up, everyone in my unit is opposed to what's going on. The thing is, most people are just afraid to stand up because they're afraid of not being paid. They're afraid of losing their benefits. That's really the kicker. But most people are saying, well, I've got like 4 months to go on my contract, so I'll just stick it out and hopefully I won't get stop lost. So far since September 11, well in excess of 200,000 soldiers have been stop lost. And right now in Iraq, 6% of all the troops in Iraq are currently stop lost.
On November 5th, when news of the Fort Hood shootings broke, Dar Jamil called the sources he'd been interviewing for reports on the mental health crisis at the military base. We reached Dar Jamil on his cell phone as he was covering the Fort Hood story shortly after it broke.
The first call I made was into a soldier who's serving at Fort Hood. He was on base when the shooting occurred. He'd actually seen and said hello to Major Hassan yesterday morning. And this is a soldier who's an Iraq War veteran. He's been getting treatment for his post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury at the base. And he was there when the shootings were going on. He didn't know who was involved. The base was under lockdown. At the time, they thought there were three gunmen. It was a very, very obviously tense situation for them. So that was the first person I called, and I spoke with him while all of it was actually happening.
You know, maybe signs of irrational behavior were overlooked in haste to get this man deployed.
From all the information we have available about what the cause of this shooting rampage might be, I think that a dramatically overstretched military and constant redeployments and soldiers in positions where they need psychiatric care and they're not getting it, this is what's happening. And while Major Hassan has not been overseas to Iraq or Afghanistan, he had been working as a counselor, hearing stories, horrific stories, giving counseling and therapy to other soldiers who'd served over in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And so he obviously had secondary trauma, which is extremely common. Even though he is a psychiatrist himself, he's been hearing these horrible stories. And then, of course, getting word that he was going to have to deploy to Afghanistan, something he was vehemently opposed to, I think that's what made him snap. But in the broader picture, when we look at these redeployments and how the military has been handling its own, as of 2008, and the statistics already out of date, obviously, even according to Army records, more than 43,000 troops listed as medically unfit for deployment had already been deployed into Iraq or Afghanistan anyway. So we look at a situation where we have a very overstretched military. They're dredging places, trying to get troops to send into Iraq or Afghanistan, even when that means sending people back over who'd already been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and or traumatic brain injury from roadside bombs.
What's the big lesson that the military is not learning?
Well, the military, I think, on the one hand, is doing what it can. Of course, folks in the military seeing the shape people are in when they come back, and then, of course, feeling the stress then of stop-lossing people and telling them they have to go back into to one or the other occupation. They're all too aware of the cost. They're all too aware of how much pressure they're under and how many problems this is causing within their ranks. But again, what can they do to rectify it when they have a commander-in-chief that is continuing on with this failed policy of both occupations and sitting here trying to determine not whether or not to pull out of Afghanistan, but how many tens of thousands more troops to send in? And this is already from a military that's overstretched, that's been involved for 6 years in Iraq, for 8 years in Afghanistan, you know, both completely failed occupations. His mindset is, well, we have to just simply send more troops. And how can we expect this type of incident at Fort Hood not to happen again, whether it be in a base in Afghanistan or a base in Baghdad or some other base at Fort Hood? But at the same time, it's not surprising that it happened at Fort Hood. This is the largest U.S. military base on the planet. It's the most heavily deployed U.S. military base. And it's also a base, obviously, that is feeling the brunt of the pressure from this. This is a base that so far this year is averaging over 10 suicides a month just at that base alone. So obviously there are some very severe problems here.
Journalist Dar Jamail, his website, dar, dahr.org. Dr. Jamshid A. Marvasti is a psychiatrist and author of the book Psychopolitical Aspects of Suicide Warriors, Terrorism and Martyrdom, A Critical View from Both Sides in Regard to Cause and Cure. The book brings perspective to the kinds of terminology used in the war on terror. On November 6th, we asked him if Nidal Malik Hassan, alleged to have killed 13 people, wounding 29 at Fort Hood, could have developed PTSD even without going to Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yes, we know that for years we are aware of something which is called vicarious traumatization or vicarious victimization. That happens when you listen to the story about trauma, about what they went through. We have seen it in police officers, we have seen it in the therapists, we have seen it in the people, United Nations, who goes to the other country to rescue people. When they come back, they are traumatized, they have nightmare, they have a flashback, they have a startled reaction, they are anxious, they are depressed, they are impulsive, their value system changed, their philosophy changed, their religion changed sometimes, they doubt the presence of the God. How could there be a God when my patient, for example, went through this kind of the abuse? Many psychiatrists and many people who work with abused victims, rape victims, they also gradually develop this kind of the symptom, and it's called PTSD. And I wouldn't be surprised if Dr. Hassan is also having the PTSD or vicarious traumatization. He really didn't go to Iraq or Afghanistan. Iraq came to him. Afghanistan came to him. He saw the worst part of the war, most likely, and that was when the soldiers were talking to him and they opening up their guts to him, and without knowing that they are really injuring him. And, of course, not having a support system, not having anyone that you could cry and any shoulder that you could put your head and cry would cause this vicarious traumatization.
Dr. Marvasti, Dr. Hassan appears to have been in all sorts of conflict. I mean, he was diagnosing soldiers. And as we've heard from Dar Jamail, they're redeployed despite having PTSD or TBI on their record as a diagnosis. And then there was the sense of conflict that just going to the Mideast as a soldier may have provoked for him as a Palestinian man.
On the basis of theory that we have, possibly the deployment was the last straw. There were many other straws that broke the camel's back. In regard to his authority, obviously, he would evaluate these soldiers. He would possibly find that they had PTSD or they had organic brain damage or whatever. He would write his note and he would recommend that not be sent back to the theater. And when he would hear that went back, they sent back, and army and superior didn't look to that's his recommendation, obviously it would have impact on him that he's not effective. They are doing things against his will. They are doing things against his recommendation. They are doing things against his patient. I mean, we need to be really very loyal to our patient. We need to be a patient advocate. We are a patient advocate. And that was obviously not helping. And in regard to people who have disorder and is still sent back to the war, it is unfortunate. I have seen people of my patient who have bipolar disorder, well-established diagnosis, and was sent. I have seen people who had a severe drug abuse were sent. I also heard that they decreased their level of the requirements, so one can be even have a criminal background and still goes to the army and goes there because of shortage. So my impression is that, yes, it was many elements that contributed and caused this man who was trained to be a healer become a killer and kill the patients, the people that he was there to help. And that is the really a puzzle for all of us. And my impression is that what really was the last straw that broke the camel's back was a deployment. That he needed to go to the source of his nightmare and flashback and most likely frightening feeling that these people brought up to him every day. And that was terrifying. He preferred to die than to go there. And that's what he did in some way.
If the patients talking to Dr. Hassan were transferring, were getting angry at him because he's Muslim and also just because he's their doctor, could he have reversed that and then gotten angry back or attacked the military?
Obviously, it is, in that case, it's a very delicate line between the enemy and friends. So the question is that who is the enemy? Did he really shoot the enemies or he shoot the people that he was treating and helping? So that is the question. Obviously, he justified in his mind. He definitely did not shoot the friends. He definitely was shooting in his mind on that moment, was shooting the enemies. These are the enemies. And how did the friend that he was treating them every day and become the enemy? One way is that these people that he was treating, they traumatize him, not only by telling him the worst story of the war, which was all the atrocity and war crime and everything that happened, but also some apparently started to belittle him or put him down or destroy his car because he, or blame him for his religion, or identify him, as you mentioned, transference. Transference means the feeling that we have toward, for example, the enemy in Iraq or Afghanistan. We transfer that feeling toward someone who has the same background or same religion or some similarity between these two. It is possible that the soldiers transfer that feeling toward him and start to look at him as an enemy. And what would happen then, he would show what we call it counter-transference. Counter-transference means that he also would look at these soldiers who are making fun of him or belittle him or criticize him as an enemy, not as a friend. Again, the example is that physician in this area who that moment killed his wife while she was a very loving woman, or he never was had any hostility toward her, but that moment friend changed to the enemy because of the flashback or because of transference.
The U.S. military seems to have missed all the signs that Dr. Hassan was getting out of control, was ready to snap.
Yeah, I think that that is the problem. Unfortunately, our military establishment has a lot of tolerance or deviation from norm. This man's behavior on the basis of the news that we have should really show a red flag, should really be on counseling, should really be seen by superior, being directed to some kind of therapy possibly, or someone should listen to him. I think that my impression of the people who take the gun in their hand or become a suicide warrior is that they have given enough message before and they were not listened to until that they get a gun and shoot someone or shoot themselves. I see it in my patient who attempt suicide, teenagers or adults. They have expressed many messages before that and no one picked it up.
That's it for Sprouts. We heard Charles McKinney of Bedford, Texas. He and his family still grieving the loss of his son, Jeff, a first sergeant who died in Iraq, leaving behind a wife and family in Germany. We also heard journalist Dar Jamail, who is on the road with a book tour. The Will to Resist is his new book. And Dr. Jamshid A. Marvasti, taped at his office in Manchester, Connecticut, where he is writing about PTSD. And we heard the music of The Story Of with their song Veterans Day. Sprouts is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, URSULA@pacifica.org. I'm Dory Smith in Storrs, Connecticut. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts. Yeah.